From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eric Clapton has a new CD. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll listen back to a 1989 interview with him about his early romance with the blues and his work with the Yardbirds and Cream. We'll also hear selections from his new CD, Pilgrim. Actor Lloyd Bridges died this week at the age of 85. We'll listen to an interview with his son, Jeff Bridges, in which he talks about growing up while his father was starring in the TV series Sea Hunt. Jeff Bridges is now starring in the new Coen Brothers film, The Big Lebowski. And film critic John Powers reviews Love and Death on Long Island, starring John Hurt and Jason Priestley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Congressman Joseph Kennedy has called a news conference for 1 hour from now. According to radio station WBZ, the Massachusetts Democrat will announce that he won't run for re-election, and in fact, he'll retire completely from politics. Kennedy is the eldest son of the late Robert F. Kennedy. The Senate has unanimously approved a resolution asking that an international tribunal try Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein for war crimes. Supporters argued that even a trial in absentia would send the proper message. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The resolution urges the president to call on the United Nations to expand the tribunal now trying Bosnian military leaders for war crimes to include Saddam Hussein. Co-sponsor Arlen Specter called it incredible that some have suggested that the Iraqi leader be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
But if Saddam Hussein is indicted by the war crimes tribunal and is tried, perhaps in absentia, it would be a clear-cut statement of exactly what Saddam Hussein is, and that is a war criminal for numerous crimes against humanity.
Specter also believes a push for a war crimes trial would put other members of the UN Security Council to the test. Specter says if they won't back U.S. military action against Iraq, they should at least condemn Saddam Hussein's actions. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
The jury in the Sergeant Major Gene McKinney sexual misconduct case is deliberating for a third day. One of the jurors threatened to quit because of disagreements among the panel. The judge said the juror expressed reluctance to continue yesterday but agreed to return this morning. The jury president, the equivalent of a foreman in a civilian court, said today things seem a bit better. Even if the juror were dismissed, the deliberations could have continued. Military juries require a minimum of 5 members with a 2/3 vote for conviction. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman today toured some heavily damaged southern farms. This week's cold temperatures have destroyed a major portion of crops in South Carolina and Georgia. Joshua Leves reports.
Temperatures in the low 20s have turned budding crops into icicles on many farms. And only now, as the ice starts to melt, are farmers able to assess the damage. This week's cold spell was particularly destructive because the winter up until now had been relatively warm, so more crops than usual were already in bloom. Estimates say southern farms have lost about 30% of their peaches and blueberries for the season, and tobacco's taken a strong hit as well. Also, winter wheat is rotting on many farms as a result of the wet conditions. State and national leaders have pledged their support to help deal with the damage. And farmers have a piece of good news today. Forecasters predict warm weather for this weekend. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
On Wall Street this hour, the Dow is up nearly 5 points in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is up 13. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Stocks are moving toward record highs today after a surprisingly strong earnings report from Oracle. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports from Washington.
Computer software stocks have made strong gains this session after Oracle issued a third quarter profit report that beat Wall Street estimates. Its stock climbed to levels not seen since the end of last year when a weak second quarter report sent Oracle shares down nearly 30% in a single session. Today, however, the stock has gained as much as 10%. Still, the market's gains have been somewhat muted because of a profit warning from Kimberly-Clark. That has put pressure on the household product sector. Kimberly-Clark shares are lower by about 13% on the day. In the Treasury's market, bond prices declined as traders looked for more evidence of slowing growth, even though the most recent producer price index showed that inflation remains tame. I'm Paul Lynn.
Financier Carl Icahn is offering to spend $43 million to get Pan Am flying again. The airline has been grounded for nearly 2 weeks after filing for bankruptcy protection. If that deal does go through, it must be approved by a bankruptcy judge. Pan Am planes could be flying again in about a month. A Swiss company is suing Reuters Corporation for copyright infringement. All Media Thaiplan claims the news organization bought some software for its journalists in Europe and then made unauthorized copies so that it paid much less in licensing fees than it should have. The Justice Department is opposing the proposed merger between Lockheed and Northrop. Government lawyers fear the merger would reduce competition. Recapping stocks at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 4.98 points at 86.64.54 in heavy trading of 276 million shares. The Nasdaq is up 13.59. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's Archive Edition, we have an interview with one of the first musicians to be called a guitar god, Eric Clapton. Early in his career in the 60s, he led the British blues revival as a member of the bands The Yardbirds, The Bluesbreakers, and Cream. The blues remain his prime inspiration, and his recent records have been enormously popular. His 1994 record From the Cradle went double platinum. In 93, he won 6 Grammys for Unplugged. Now he has a new CD called Pilgrim, featuring mostly new songs written or co-written by Clapton. Before we hear our 1989 interview, let's hear the first single from the new CD. This is My Father's Eyes. In 1989, I asked Eric Clapton how he discovered the music of African-American blues performers.
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar, and country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunzi, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was, I don't know why, I was immensely attracted to the sound, I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music, and I decided to kind of examine it, investigate, and so I became a blues collector, as a, you know, buying export blues records at export shops, and I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players, and that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about 4 or 5 people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a 6-string guitar, and I didn't know how to tune it, you know, I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it. And I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those Teach Yourself How to Play Basic Guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was a kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of song. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see. And in actual fact, it was all being done before. But it was a great. I prefer to think of doing it that way because I felt like I was discovering it all.
You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all. But we were very poor, and it was like... You know, it was. I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't. Maybe not. But I tend to identify with it in that way, and I kind of dreamt of myself being this this lonesome blues singer. You know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson. Yeah, and I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which is more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. A very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this... I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that I... Being that I was one of the only people playing in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed. A little bit possessive and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know. And I kind of the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon, you know. It was a bewildering experience.
You know, you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not...
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues, but it was all in an unreal situation and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assumed would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and... you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because... I think that what happened with the Yardbirds was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were... We were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted after that to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. Let's get back to his days with the Yardbirds. This was their first hit, For Your Love, which came out in 1965.
Days that will excite and make you dream of me at night.
You were early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. If I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's like all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was heartbreaking. It was really actually very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments of my life, because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like this. So, I don't know, it just really floored me, and for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that. But I guess I was young and impetuous, and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Blues Breakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. I got the blues about me so-and-so, and the sun got the blues about me. Thank you.
Well, after the Blues Breakers with Joan Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker. And you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was one of the he was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary. And he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that. And I was, for quite a while, under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
Freedom, I think. I during the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Blues Breakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Clapton has a new recording called Pilgrim. On this archive edition, we're listening to an interview we recorded in 1989. Here he is with Cream, jamming on Crossroads, the Robert Johnson blues classic that Cream turned into a rock hit. What was it like for you to learn to take sustained solos in concerts? Were you used to doing that before Cream?
Yes, I think we did it with... I think John would encourage me to play as long as I liked, but I had a much more controlled idea about what it should be then. With Cream, it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more, and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play, and we would just play off the top of our heads, and it worked. A lot of the time it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times at Fillmore West when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I mean, I thought
okay.
It was fantastic.
My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records?
Tired eyes. I'll soon be with you, my love. Give you my dawn surprise.
On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that, that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theatre in London called the Savile Theatre where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimmy play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimmy properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed. And that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, that wasn't the... It was the other way around from the way that you think. It, mm-hmm. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song. We added the song to the riff.
And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer
on. Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life, in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think...
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London. And it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with Clapton is God written on it in white, chalk or paint, I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And as far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I you know, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
First, in the early days, I would just, I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
Eric Clapton, recorded in 1989. We'll hear more of that interview in the second half of the show. Clapton has a new CD called Pilgrim. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
In the lonely night, in the sky, dust of a pale moonlight.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jeff Bridges talks about growing up while his father starred in the TV series Sea Hunt. Lloyd Bridges died earlier this week. Film critic John Powers reviews Love and Death on Long Island, and we continue our conversation with Eric Clapton. We're listening to his new CD.
Thank you. miss you, baby, and I won't have you driving me insane. I was in love with you, baby, till the day you brought me down so low. I was in love with you, baby.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring an interview with Eric Clapton. He has a new CD called Pilgrim. Our interview was recorded in 1989.
A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times. Maybe it was in Rolling Stone. New York Times? Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film where we're stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house, and waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game, a musical game, for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what I mean. I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really we were selling the audiences short. You know, we were going on stage stoned, and we were playing just kind of meaningless, a lot of the time anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing, because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that.
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another. And then we talked to the manager about it. He decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
You, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off. You know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed. You know, we were probably going to do, in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums and we weren't ready. We had barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs. Yeah, I can't remember where it started. I've always been I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another, an obsessive personality to say the least. And even when I was 16, it was like peer pressure. To everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life. It seemed to be to get stoned. And I realized now that I was going to end up, you know, on the heap. And I pretty well got close to that. And during the early 70s, I got as close to killing myself with drugs as I could ever get. And it started out the way it always starts out, you know, smoking a joint or taking a few pills. And for some people, it escalates very quick. For me, it took a long time. But I got there, and I diced with death for a while. And I regret it, that's for sure.
Did you have, like, a bottoming out moment where you figured, this is it, I've got to change?
I think it's funny because it's difficult to be... I mean, when you are that stoned, it's difficult to be... to stand outside of yourself and see how far you've gone, you know, because you're so wrapped up in it. Other people can tell you, but it's very difficult for you to see yourself. And it happened to me at some point. I'd had friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my jailers, you know. They were making sure that I didn't harm myself. I was taking lots of heroin. I was taking Mandrax, which is a powerful, like a Quaalude equivalent. I was drinking lots of hard liquor. And at some point, I remember seeing myself, and this is true, sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it. And what I was doing, I was trying to escape from my own house where these people were trying to look after me. And thank God, one of the guys had taken out the rotor arm of the engine, and I was just sitting there trying to start the car, totally naked. I don't know where I was going to go, but I had a flash then that things had gone a little too far. So that was when I decided to kind of start doing something about it.
And what did you do?
I went to an acupuncturist who had set up a practice in London using a fairly revolutionary form of treatment whereby she passed a small electric current from one ear to the other and induced a sort of a mild natural narcosis, which took away the withdrawal symptoms which you get when you're trying to stop taking heroin.
Mm-hmm.
The point was, of course, that I hadn't actually used it. I'd never taken heroin intravenously, so it wasn't that hard a habit for me to kick. It was quite hard, but I did it with the help of this acupuncturist.
Did you ever think that an addiction to drugs, an obsession with drugs, is kind of related to, in a way, the same kind of obsession that allows you to spend as many hours as you must have developing your guitar playing? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive about guitar playing and about your music.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I like to think of my guitar, my love for guitar playing, as being dedicated. But it's not far removed from being obsessive. I mean, there's a fine line between those two words. And what happened when I became obsessed with drug taking was that obviously my guitar playing took second place. And you know, one is a natural kind of dedication, and the other one is a very unnatural dedication.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something about your past, about your very beginnings, actually. I know you've talked about this, that your mother had you, she wasn't married, and she left, I think, shortly after you were born, and you were brought up by your grandparents, who told you that they were actually your parents, and when your mother returned, you were told at first that she was your sister. And I'm wondering what effects you think that had on your public identity. Do you know what I mean? On your public sense of self.
It's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, whatever the result was, has to be a complicated result, isn't it, when you think about it? I've got so many different sides of my nature as a result of that upbringing. I mean, I think there's a side of me that, you know, dreads rejection, dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude, and I don't know. It's had all kinds of effects on me, most of which I've kind of started to deal with over the last few years and come to terms with. And if I can, I change parts of my personality that cause me difficulty, or I at least accept them. But for sure, it was an unusual upbringing, you know.
You said that at some point in your career that you got bored with virtuoso musicianship. What was the turning point for you?
Well, I think that might have been a very glib way for me to say that I couldn't get it any better. I actually had reached the end of my capabilities, I think. And a lot of people were taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it, and it was probably better off for my face to say that I was getting bored, you know.
So after you felt you couldn't take it any further, you wanted to turn to something else?
No, I just realized that technically my potential was probably had come to its end. You know, I'm not that nimble, really. I don't think I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar sort of championships. So I tended to go the other way.
By going the other way, you mean singing more?
Yeah, singing more, or just kind of refining my technique to somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it,
by
doing less, you know.
Eric Clapton, recorded in 1989. Well, here's another song from his new CD, Pilgrim. Coming up, Jeff Bridges talks about his father, Lloyd Bridges, who died this week. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Bridges is starring in the new Coen Brothers film, The Big Lebowski. He's part of an acting family. His brother is Beau Bridges. Their father, Lloyd Bridges, died Tuesday at the age of 85. We're going to hear an excerpt of a 1993 interview in which Jeff looked back on growing up during the years his father was spending a lot of time underwater shooting the TV series Sea Hunt about the adventures of a deep-sea diver. The series ran from 1957 to 61. Can we go back to the beginning, talk about your early days?
Sure.
Okay. I have to confess to you that, like a lot of, I'm about your age. I think I'm a year
younger than you are. So, like a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of people, I grew up watching Sea Hunt, right?
That's right.
I grew up living in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, but I knew how to prevent getting the bends.
Very good.
Yeah, like this is going to be real useful information to me.
can you hum the Sea Hunt theme?
Gosh, you know, I don't think I can. Can you? Go ahead.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. Something like that. I got to get off there at the end.
No, were your friends, did they watch the show, and did that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah, sure. They watched the show. A lot of them liked it. You know, occasionally I would get the, you think you're so great, you're Mike Nelson's kid. Yeah, you think you're real great, don't you? You know, I get some of that. But all in all, it was, you know, the kids pretty much dug it, I thought.
You were on some episodes when you were a kid. How old were you, and what were the scenes? What did you have to do?
Oh, I was about, I think on the first one, maybe about 9 years old. I remember being trapped in a cave, and Mike Nelson had to dive under there and get me. And my girlfriend of the time, my neighbor, Andy Kaplan, was playing my partner in that one. And my dad, Mike Nelson, had to swim under there and save us. And I remember telling my girlfriend, I said, well, maybe if we sing, they'll hear us and they'll save us. And I had to sing a song.
Underwater? Oh, this was an underwater cave. This was a regular cave.
It's like, you know, the tide is rising, you know, and trapped us in this cave.
Of course, of course.
I remember being thrown off Malibu Pier in the middle of winter and, you know, having to say my lines with the cold water, you know, that sort of thing.
Whose idea was it for you to do the episodes, yours or your father's?
It was my dad's. You know, he said, there's a little kid part in here, you want to do it? And took me a second, then I realized I could get out of school for the week, and so I said, yeah, I'll do that.
Let me ask you, your brother Beau Bridges was 9 years older than you. Did he ever have to take care of you when you were young, and did you, like, tag along with him and his friends against his will?
Being 8 years older, it was almost, a lot of times it was a kind of an uncle, nephew relationship almost.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have the typical kind of competition, really. He I looked up to him, and he was always so great in sports. He was scouted by the Dodgers, you know, and he was on the UCLA basketball team, and for a guy who is, I think he's about 5'10 or 11, you know, he was playing out there with Walt Hazard and all those guys. And, he taught me how to do all those sports and box and everything. So he was, I really did look up to him. He really was my hero. And then he taught me how to act, and we would do, this idea we came up with where, you know, so often you talk to actors and they say, you know, it's tough because we need an audience, you know, and there's no audience. You can't just act in your room by yourself. That's not gratifying at all. So what Beau and I would do is we'd rent a flatbed truck, and we would play the supermarket circuit. We would get a few scenes together, and we would go into a supermarket parking lot. And we would get on the back of the flatbed truck, and we would act, and we would get people to all come around and watch our show and improvise and do kind of crazy things until the cops would come, and then we'd try to include the cops in the show, and they would kind of get flustered, and then one of us would get in the driver's seat and drive off to the next supermarket.
So it's kind of a strange thing to do, pull up a flatbed truck to a supermarket parking lot and put on a little show. What did people make of it?
I don't know. You know, sometimes we would start it with a fight. My father taught us how to fake fight, you know, do stage fighting. So sometimes we would start it with a fight, you know, to get people saying, what's happening? To get a crowd around us. And then we would say, we're just kidding. We're going to put on a show. And then they'd gather around. It's a good idea. I recommend it highly for all you actors out there who need an audience.
Now, one of your early films was the remake of King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Did it turn out like you expected?
Oh, not really. You know, I was a big fan of the original. I remember, faking sick just to get out of school to see that thing. You know, I love that original movie.
Me too.
And it worked all right. I mean, it was tough. It's a tough acting assignment to have to do all that, you know, with all the technical stuff, because that the acting kind of takes a back seat to that.
Did you have to do a lot of scenes in which there was a mechanical ape arm playing opposite you?
I did a few of those, but I remember being on the set when Jessica Lange was in this hand, and God, the camera should have been turned the other way, because I've never had this feeling, a combination of horror and laughing my head off, seeing the director, who was this English guy, directing these five Italians. Each man had a finger on this giant, had a control that controlled the finger of this huge gorilla paw. And Jesse was in this paw, and he finally, you know, he couldn't communicate with these guys in words, so he finally said, "Just look at my bloody hand." And he stuck his hand up in the air. He had all these five Italian guys looking at his hand, trying to, you know, figure out how much he should squeeze the fingers. And Jessica almost got crushed several times. I mean, you know, it was very painful for her. Terrible situation.
I hear you laughing.
Yeah, well, it's very, very strange.
I've got one last question for you.
Yay.
Did you ever get the bends?
Did I ever get the bends? No, but I've had nitrogen narcosis several times.
Have you really?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I haven't, but I would like to have.
Did you ever go deep sea diving?
Yes, to get nitrogen narcosis. I've been skin diving. Yeah, especially when my dad was doing Sea Hunt, we would go skin diving quite a bit, and also scuba diving.
Jeff Bridges recorded in 1993. You can see Jeff Bridges in the new movie The Big Lebowski. His father, Lloyd Bridges, died Tuesday at the age of 85. Coming up, a review of the new film Love and Death on Long Island. This is Fresh Air. Odd couples have always been a staple of the movies. The new film, Love and Death on Long Island, matches a stodgy English writer, played by John Hurt, with an American teen idol, played by American teen idol Jason Priestley. John Powers has a review.
Before World War II, writers told stories about innocent Americans falling into the clutches of worldly Europeans. Nowadays, the pattern's been reversed. Whether it's Michelle Piccoli being bullied by Jack Palance in Contempt, or Humbert Humbert falling for the gum-chewing nymph at Lolita, we're in an era when sophisticated Europeans are constantly being seduced by vulgar Americana. That's precisely what happens in Love and Death on Long Island, a sly postmodern riff on Death in Venice. John Hurt stars as English novelist Giles de Ath, a reclusive widower who's utterly out of place in the late 20th century. He's allergic to technology, persnickety about language, and incredulous that anyone could object to his incessant smoking. All this changes when, trying to see an E.M. Forster adaptation at a local multiplex, Giles mistakenly stumbles into a theater showing a teen comedy called Hot Pants College 2. It's here that he first spies Ronnie Bostock, played by Jason Priestley, an American teen idol whose grinning screen visage hits the old fogey like a toke from a crack pipe. Instantly hooked, Giles buys a VCR to watch Ronnie's old movies and starts furtively collecting what he calls Bostockiana, mainly photos of Ronnie from the fanzines. But his obsession only grows, and soon he's traveling to the Long Island town where Ronnie lives with his girlfriend, a fashion model played by Fiona Loewy. There, Giles worms his way into the talentless young actor's life. At one point, the two sit together, reading the script to Hot Pants College 3.
Hey, man, don't grief out on me.
Sorry, man. Just feeling a bit lonesome, you know?
Hey, you're a college boy now. All those babes don't want to see you lonesome.
Sure. Like I'm Mr. Popular.
Well, I'm going to make you Mr. Popular. And that's a promise. A poignant little scene.
Yeah, it sets up the whole storyline. See, I go to college. All the college girls try to mother me, but I fall in love with a teacher whose husband turns out to be a grand wizard in the KKK.
Something of a message there?
That's the usual stuff.
Based on a cult novel by Gilbert Adair, Love and Death on Long Island is the directorial debut of Richard Kwietniewski, a 40-year-old Englishman whose admirably simple style lets him glide between social comedy, pop cult parody, and genuine tenderness. The opening hour is filled with great bits, like the hilarious excerpt from Ronnie's teen comedy Skidmarks, which builds to the tagline, "You're just a skidmark on the underpants of life." Gradually, however, the movie's tone deepens, and though it never approaches the level of Contempt or Lolita, Giles' story does become suffused with a touching sense of regret. The movie's carried by the riveting Hurt, a perpetually haggard actor who, to steal a line from Raymond Chandler, has a face like a lost battle. Hurt's greatest roles, like The Elephant Man, Caligula and I, Claudius, or Quentin Crisp in The Naked Civil Servant, have always shown off his gift for capturing outsiders and eccentrics. His performance here is a triumph of comic nuance, winning big laughs with his deadpan rasp and revealing Giles' inner turmoil with the merest glint of his basilisk eye. Hurt's world-weary charisma brings out the best in Priestley, whose years in the 90210 ghetto have made him the butt of countless jokes. Sending up his own pretty boy persona, Priestley reveals hidden resources, especially in the scene where Ronnie finally grasps that Giles is in love with him. Those smug bovine features suddenly melt, revealing an unexpected decency and compassion. Love and Death on Long Island isn't simply the story of one writer's obsession, but a fable about the relation between high art and pop culture. Although Giles is sublimely attuned to the infinite niceties of meaning, he's also effete and dried out. What restores him is Hot Pants College 2, with its miraculous glimpse of Ronnie Bostock, whose only hope for immortality lies in the refined story that Giles tells about him. At one point, Giles explains his attraction to Ronnie, which is less sexual than aesthetic. It's about, he says, the discovery of beauty where no one ever thought of looking for it. One might say the same thing about this film, which discovers something poignant, maybe even profound, in the tale of a dim-bulb actor and the literary curmudgeon who adores him.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scherr. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.